I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times.
We have started our constant velocity accordion, which means we are conducting the sky crane, about to conduct the sky crane maneuver. Sky crane maneuver has started, about 20 meters off the surface.
We're getting signals from MRO.
Tango Delta.
Touchdown confirmed. Perseverance safely on the surface of Mars, ready to begin seeking the sands of past life.
That was the sound of the robotic rover Perseverance landing on Mars last month after a seven-month journey through space. Its mission is to search for signs of ancient life on the red planet by exploring and collecting rocks from Jezero Crater. It's been sending back extraordinary photographs and videos. It will also be testing a small 4-pound helicopter named Ingenuity to see if it can take flight in the Martian atmosphere, which would be a first. Well, here to catch us up on the mission are two people, our two guests. Ken Williford is Deputy Project Scientist for the NASA Mars 2020 mission. He's also the director of the JPL Astrobio Geochemistry Laboratory. And Ken Williford, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good to be with you.
Also with us and joining us by Skype is Kendall Lynch. She is a University Space Research Association staff scientist, also an astrobiologist at the Lunar and Planetary Institute in Houston, Texas. Kendall Lynch, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good morning. So glad to be here.
Nice to have you both with us. And Ken, if I could start with you and just, it's been almost a month since Perseverance landed on Mars, but even hearing the audio of that landing or even rewatching the video, do you still get chills and thrills?
Absolutely. Goosebumps when I heard it again. It's all still very exciting.
Still very exciting, which is one of the reasons we still wanted to talk to you. And how about for you, Kenda, as someone who's, you know, in love with space travel and all of that?
Yes, it still makes me tear up. I've participated. I've watched every single Mars launch in the last decade or so. And every time I hear the feed, it just makes me tear up and cry with pride that every time that we accomplish something so wonderful.
Let me ask you, Ken, how has Perseverance been performing as hoped and as expected?
Yes, it's really been spectacular. And hats off to the team of engineers and scientists who've been working through the night. I don't know if you know, but we work on Mars time for the first few months of the mission, which is grueling. But all this excitement of all the new images keeps us going in the middle of the night when we have to. So it's been just great. Yeah, we're really fortunate.
And Mars time is the middle of the night just because it's Mars, right?
Well, it sweeps across the Earth day. So the Earth day and the Mars day, that is the length of the day on the different planets, is quite similar, but not exactly the same. And we operate on Mars time so that the scientists and engineers can do all of our work to build the plans that we send up to the rover while the rover is sleeping. And then we get our sleep while the rover is doing its job on Mars. And that's the way we can get the most efficiency out of the rover. Eventually, we'll move into modified Earth time where we have a more normal Earth-based schedule, but we lose some efficiency that way. And so we try to eke out as much as we can in that first few months while people's minds and bodies can handle it. And then we relax a little bit.
And what's the rover doing today? Whatever today means in Martian time.
Yeah, well, it's funny. We say to sol because we call the Martian day a sol. And so we plan each sol. And so to sol, we're sending up a plan to drop the belly pan, which is the sort of bottom cover of this very complex robot within a robot called the Adaptive Caching Assembly, or the ACA. And this is, it looks like a little Coke bottling plant inside the rover, and it's the thing that processes our samples. So I'm sure we'll talk about later, one of our objectives is to collect core samples. And this is the robot inside the rover that processes those core samples. And its bottom cover is ejectable. So it's covered when we land to protect that whole system from the entry, descent, and landing process, but then we drop it off. And so we're going to do that. We're also getting ready to deploy the Ingenuity helicopter. And so it's a lot of exciting stuff.
Yeah. Kendall, let me go back to you and tell us about Jezero Crater and why it was important for Perseverance to not just land there, but also to be able to do the research there. What do you hope to find?
Well, Jezero Crater is what we believe is a ancient paleolake basin, which means that a long time ago on Mars, there was a lake there, and we have evidence of that because of the beautiful, beautiful deltaic deposits that Perseverance is hopefully going to go and take a look at here once she can actually start motoring a little bit more. And why it's important for us to go there and why we want to go there is because that deposit, first of all, it gives us evidence that there was flowing water there, but delta deposits are great places to look for preserved organics and potential great places to preserve biosignatures from multiple different sources, especially in Jezero. So what we're hoping to do is we're hoping to look for potential biosignatures in particular in those deltaic deposits. And we just have a multitude of different possible habitable environments that we can look at in Jezero. It's very exciting.
And just to underscore what you just said, which is there was water on Mars. That we know that to be true, Kenda?
Absolutely, yes. We have a lot of evidence from just our orbital observations and our other previous Mars missions. Curiosity and Gale Crater is exploring another paleolake basin, and Spirit and Opportunity gave us some of our first evidence that we actually had liquid flowing water on Mars. So we definitely know that liquid water flowed on the surface of Mars in its history.
And Ken, going back to you, so the rover will be what, exploring these rocks, drilling into these rocks? What will the rover be doing to try to understand water and whether there was life on this planet?
Well, that's right. So we really start off just as any geologist would, and so. One way the rover has been described by a friend of mine at JPL is our robotic emissary or our avatar. So it's really, we think of this rover doing the exploration, but it's really humans, of course, doing the exploration, and the rover is our tool. And so it's a bunch of geologists sitting on Earth telling this rover what to do, geologists and planetary scientists and astrobiologists and all kinds of scientists and engineers. But anyway, we start with the basics of geology. So we're just looking around us using our senses as enabled by the rover's instruments to understand the processes of formation and alteration that led to all the rocks that we see around us. And we're asking the question, what was the environment like at the time these rocks were deposited? So this is what Kenda was starting to talk about. It. We think we're sitting where... You know, there used to be a lake, you know, there used to be water above our heads where the rover is sitting right now. And off to the west is a delta. And so eventually we're going to get there and we're going to explore all different kinds of environments and use our instruments to, once we understand what that environment was like, we ask this question, was that environment habitable? Which means, could it have supported life? And by that we mean microbial life. So we think it's very unlikely that complex life like animals and plants that we know on Earth today, we think it's unlikely that that sort of life ever evolved on Mars, but it's possible that things like bacteria could have evolved on Mars, and that's what we're looking for. And so we're looking for those biosignatures that Kenda talked about, signs that organisms like that can leave in the geologic record. And we know that from Earth, from the oldest rocks that we have on Earth, that were formed at a time when all life was microscopic and microbial, life does leave its signs that are recognizable in the rock. So we're using our instruments to look for those. And then, as you said, we'll collect samples that we think give us the best chance of finding any signs of life, but also signs of how Mars evolved as a planetary system. And then eventually, the plan is for those samples to get back to Earth for future study.
And Kenna, let me segue from Mars to Earth. I know that you've been doing research in Utah, perhaps, you know, sort of looking for some of the same things, if I can put it in that sort of generic way, same things that rover might be looking for in Mars.
Yes. So what we do as astrobiologists, and Ken, both Ken and I are very well versed in doing this, you know, right now we have a data point of one Earth to learn about how life evolved, how it, you know, how it came to be, how it evolved, and the extent of the different kind of environments it can live in. And we need to have an understanding of the different types of places and environments and the extent of life so that we can try to figure out, A, what life is, and how do we look for it? How do we verify that we have life, and then therefore go look for it on another planet? So we do a lot of analog research here on Earth in various different extreme environments that we think are representative of planet of environments that would have been normal environments on other planets like Mars. And so I study a Paleolithic basin in the Great Salt Lake Desert in northwestern Utah as an analog environment for paleolakes like Jezero Crater and even Gale Crater. And we're trying to understand one particular type of habitable environment that could have existed in those paleolake basins in the actual subsurface wow. where groundwater could still be moving and we could have life living there. We're trying to understand how the life lives there, how what kind of biosignatures it could lead so that we can inform and help the science team working on Mars with the rovers to help them figure out how to look for these kind of signals and biosignatures with their instruments.
And is there any way, Kenda, just looking at some of the video and photographs coming back from Perseverance from Mars, just sort of looking at it, eyeballing it, are there things that strike you that seem interesting, that seem worth investigating?
Oh, well, right away, it looks just like my field environment. The first couple of pictures came down and I felt like I was standing in my Paleolithic basin in Pilot Valley. I was like, this is what Pilot Valley looks like. It's so amazing. You know, it's just the same, you know, off to the distance, the same kind of mountains off to the distance, the very, very, very flat basin floor that you expect a Paleolithic playa, a playa environment to look like. And then you can start to see different kind of layerings in the distant mountains that you could see off in the distance. So it was just striking to me how similar it looked just from the initial pictures that I've been able to see so far to what I see every day in my field environment.
Well, that's fascinating. Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Kendall Lynch. She's a University Space Research Association staff scientist, also an astrobiologist at the Lunar and Planetary Institute located in Houston, Texas, joining us by Skype. And Ken Williford is with us as well. He's deputy project scientist for the NASA Mars 2020 mission, also director of the JPL Astrobio Geochemistry Laboratory. And we're talking about Perseverance, which landed on Mars just a couple of weeks ago, back in February, and talking about what we hope to find and what this rover is doing. And you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And today on the show, we're getting an update on what the rover Perseverance has been doing since landing on Mars, the red planet, last month. Later in the hour, we'll be talking about how the commercial space industry is changing space travel, including tourism. And again, you can join us, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Ken Williford, let me go back to you and just talk a little bit more about this rover. It is nuclear powered, as I understand it, not solar powered. Why is that?
Well, there's pros and cons to the different ways to power rovers. Some of the past rovers were solar powered. A great thing about that, you know, the solar panels can be sort of lighter and there's nothing intrinsic to the solar panel itself that causes it to degrade over time, whereas the nuclear fuel, what we call it, the multi-mission radioisotope thermal generator, the MMRTG, that fuel source sort of declines in output over time. It's over quite a long time, but the amount of power it can generate does decline over time. Solar panels, the drawback is that when they get covered by dust, their power generation is lower. And so it's all sort of pros and cons. That with solar panels, you're more tied to the seasonality on Mars, and the we call it the insulation, not like the stuff you put in your house, but the amount of sunlight that's hitting you in any given place. And so just like solar panels on your house, you know, you generate a lot of electricity in the summer and not so much in the winter. Same deal with solar panels. Whereas with the MMRTG, it's a much more predictable kind of constant output of power. And so it just depends what you want to do with your mission. And for a mission like Mars 2020, it was really important to go with the MMRTG.
And to you, Kendall Lynch, when these rocks are brought back from Mars, which my understanding is will take some time for that to happen, what will you be looking for specifically in these rocks that are brought back?
Well, the entire, you know, science community will be looking for multiple different types of biosignatures. Everybody who's able to get a sample will be trying to do a multitude of different techniques. We'll be looking to confirm anything that the rover instruments found. Like if a pixel finds an interesting structure or an interesting element, we'll be looking for different types of configuration of elements. We'll be looking at those different structures. If we find organics with Sherlock, we'll probably be trying to look at those organics in more detail and characterize them more when you get them back on Earth. We'll probably be trying to do so many other different things. We'll try to do other types of microanalysis, looking for isotopes and other kind of small scale evidence of biosignatures. So there's a whole swath of different things that we'll be looking for. For determining if we have biosignatures and evidence of life, we need to do multiple mutually confirming tests, and we really need to put our science through its paces to make sure that if we want to declare we have a positive result and we found some evidence of life, we're going to have lots of multiple tests give us a thumbs up saying, yep, we found something, and we all kind of agree that we found something that is potentially from life. So it's going to be a lot of different tests.
And I'm assuming we're talking years, right, Kenda?
Probably, yeah. Years and science done in multiple different labs, across the U.S. and probably across the globe with our international partners as well. This is a science community effort to verify the results and to analyze these rocks when they come back to Earth.
And Ken, let's say you do find, you know, signs of life. What will that mean? What will that tell us?
Well, it's would be truly profound. I mean, this is one of the biggest questions that we could possibly be asking, you know, in science. The question being, you know, are we alone? That's often how we phrase the question. But, you know, I think it's a question that people have been asking since there have been people, you know. I mean, since it's a basic human question. Am I alone here? Am I alone in the world? Am I alone in the solar system? Am I alone in the universe? And we'd like to know. We have this just, you know, extraordinarily beautiful and complex planet with all kinds of life and diversity. But we have no idea. It's like Kenda said, we have a sample of one. You know, we know it's possible for life to emerge on a planet, but we don't know how common that is. You know, it's possible on one hand that life could be completely widespread, you know, that anywhere that the conditions are right, the sort of chemical and environmental conditions are right, life just emerges. It's just sort of an inherent property of matter, in a sense. That's one possibility. The opposite end member scenario is that life is extraordinarily rare, that, you know, all the way to maybe it only ever happened once, you know, maybe that chemical chemistry to biology transformation is so rare that it only ever happened once. Right now we have no idea. You know, we can speculate, and astrobiologists like Kenda and like me I think we probably wouldn't be doing it if we didn't think that life is probably widespread and that there's a chance we could find it. But this mission and Mars sample return, I think, is our best opportunity in our lifetimes to really seriously address that question. There are many other approaches that NASA and other institutions are taking, but this is a really fantastic opportunity that we have as a species, really, to really seriously address that question. And let me just add one quick thing to what Kenda said about the what we call return sample science. And it's right that we focus so much on the astrobiology because it's so exciting. But I want to make sure your listeners are aware that the science of Mars sample return is so much bigger even than that. And we have this opportunity to understand the evolution of another terrestrial planet. And that's what we call the rocky planets like Earth, Mars, and Venus. We have this incredible opportunity to understand a planetary neighbor in a way that we never have before by choosing rocks specifically from its surface and bringing them back and studying them in all of the best ways we can back on Earth. So how did Mars become habitable as a planet? How did it turn from a habitable place with abundant liquid water on the surface to this desolate environment that we see today? And, we think that had to do with the loss of its atmosphere. How did that happen? So all of those questions, how did terrestrial planets form? How did our solar system form? There are huge scientific questions that these samples open up really for generations. So I expect it'll be similar to the Apollo samples that came back, which really transformed science, and people are still reaping great dividends from those today.
Do you think, Kenda, that Mars could be a kind of a cautionary tale for the Earth, for us on Earth?
I definitely think it's a cautionary tale, yes, and I think it's definitely informative to help us understand, like Ken said, it's going to help us understand the evolution of another planet, how it became habitable, how it became uninhabitable. And yes, I do think that translates to helping us understand our own cradle, how special our Earth is, how it became habitable itself, how we came to be, and then what a potential future for our planet is, both with our influence and without it. Having an understanding of where our planet, what the future of our planet is, and in addition to that, being able to understand another planet and explore could open up possibilities for us to go out and explore even further beyond Mars. And so I think having these samples come back and learning everything that we're going to be able to learn from those samples, like Ken said, just more than the astrobiology, but learning the planetary evolution, the history, just opens up our ability to explore our solar system and our universe even so much more. And I hope it will be transformative and really exciting our global population to want to see more space exploration and more humans doing space exploration as well, which is hopefully our next step is then sending humans to Mars after we do some of this really important robotic work and send those samples back to Earth.
I do want to pick up on that. Ken, as you're talking, I'm thinking of those early pictures from the moon, when we put, actual men on the moon, and those pictures back at Earth and how green and blue and white we were in many ways.
Right. Yeah.
Powerful. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Kenda Lynch. She's a University Space Research Association staff scientist, also an astrobiologist at the Lunar and Planetary Institute in Houston, Texas. Ken Williford, deputy project scientist for the NASA Mars 2020 mission, which is what we're talking about. Also director of the JPL Astrobio Geochemistry Laboratory. And again, you can join our conversation, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Ken, Bill has a question. What evidence is there that shows that there was water on Mars and not some other liquid?
Yes, it's a great question, and there's a long history of asking that question, and it started out, as Kenda mentioned, from orbit, where we have these, we're so fortunate to have these satellites orbiting Mars. We call them the orbiters, and they're just like satellites that orbit around Earth, and they take beautiful pictures. And over the years and decades, the resolution of those pictures has increased. So we've gotten better and bigger cameras. And now they're really just spectacular. And so you can see these patterns on the ground that are, you know, indicate flowing water. And but as you said, you know, how do you know that's water and not some other flowing liquid? That was the question. And
right.
And this was the really the main focus of the earlier Mars rovers, the Mars Exploration Rover Spirit and Opportunity. They were taking this strategy that they called follow the water. And it was, you know, motivated by astrobiology and by the idea that all life that we know of on Earth requires liquid water at some time in its life cycle. So the idea was if you could go and confirm that there was liquid water in the past, that would tell you something about the habitability of the planet. And indeed, those rovers both found mineral evidence. So now we're getting to chemistry and mineralogy on the surface of Mars that goes beyond just looking at a picture. You know, so the pictures are great, but you'd like to confirm that just like we do on Earth. We bring back a rock sample from our field area. Kenda brings back one of these rocks deposited in the old lake that she studies, brings it back to the lab, and we can look for minerals in there that we know from Earth can only form in the presence of liquid water. And so that's how the evidence started to build, and it's just gotten more and more solid, that case that there was abundant liquid water on Mars ever since then. And so we're very, very confident at this point, and so we can now start to ask more nuanced questions.
Ken, just picking up on what you said earlier about the idea that if we can answer some of these very important questions, then we can consider sending humans to Mars. And it is it's an inhospitable place to humans. What can human beings do on Mars that this rover could not?
Well, a lot, actually. Even though the rover is our avatar and we love our exploration rovers, they have done so much science for us. You know, there's about a 22-minute delay, you know, in decision-making processes, and it's a little harder for the rover to kind of think on its feet. If it sees something unique, it can't kind of make a quick decision to do something else or take a different kind of sample. It kind of has to do what the human team back on Earth tells it to do with the time and the power that it has with a human on Mars, you know, with an instrument suite to support them back in a habitat, you know, and a local lab. They can make a little bit more, nuanced and specific decisions. Make quick decisions if they see something interesting based on their expertise. They can take an extra sample. They can do a little bit of extra work because they're there. They can go sample and take it back to the lab, look at some things, dump the sample if it doesn't work, and go sample again. Whereas our Mars rover, even though it can dump samples, it is limited in what it can bring back to Earth for us and what it can do. And it is a little time limited because it's a rover and it has to take commands from Earth in some ways. So humans can do a little bit faster, but sending humans does complicate things because we're humans and we're life and we have life all over us, and so we have to be careful about sending humans to make sure that when we're still looking for life and trying to explore Mars that we don't over-contaminate it or cause problems. So there's a lot of challenges that we have to deal with to make sure that if and when we can send humans, we do it safely, both for our human astronauts so that they can come back to Earth safely, and also so that we don't contaminate and damage our planet at Mars.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Ken, what is Curiosity doing on Mars?
Curiosity is still going strong, and they, that mission landed in Gale Crater, and with this beautiful opportunity to kind of explore a sort of time history of this shift in planetary habitability that we've been talking about, where Mars went, we think, from a very much more habitable place, much more Earth-like, still probably, you know, not like, maybe never as habitable as Earth has ever been, but much more Earth-like than it is today, wetter, and then it shifted. Maybe the atmosphere was lost. Apparently the atmosphere was lost, and it turned into a dry, inhospitable place. And we can think of that as, it's sometimes called the great drying of Mars. You know, it's almost like the whole thing just dried up. And in Gale Crater, there's this beautiful sequence of rocks going up Mount Sharp that seem to capture that transition. And you move from a sequence of rocks that has a lot of clay in it. And, you know from a kind of muddy swamp or a lake that, you know, mud turns into clay. And then into these sulfate-bearing rocks. And sulfate, an example of a sulfate mineral is gypsum, like what sheetrock is made of. But if you go to a, Kenda said the word playa, so this desert lake environment, if you think of a lake that is seasonal and dries up, you know, every summer, you'll see at the edges of that lake salt crystals forming as the water dries up. And some of the salts that form there are gypsum. And anyway, in the layers above the clay-bearing layers in Gale Crater, you see a lot of sulfate minerals, and it goes even from there to, you know, no clays, no sulfates, just sort of sand, and it looks like wind-blown sand in this sort of just dusty desert, you know, totally dry environment. And right now, I believe they're sort of in and around that clay-sulfate transition, which is something that a lot of us have been very excited about for a long time. I'm not actually on the Curiosity team, so I'm not totally sure exactly where they are right now, but it's my impression that they're just beginning or about to begin exploring those sulfates, which is so exciting.
Well, we have to end our conversation. I regret to say that. Thank you both for joining us today in Radio Times and getting us almost as excited as you are about what's happening on Mars. Ken Williford, thank you so much.
So good to be with you today.
You're very welcome. And he's Deputy Project Scientist for the NASA Mars 2020 mission. Kendall Lynch, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you so much. It's been a joy to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And she's a University Space Research Association staff scientist. And coming up, we'll be talking about the commercial space industry. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. While NASA's rover Perseverance begins its exploration of Mars, there's a growing commercialization of space closer to Earth. Some very wealthy men are building spaceships, ferrying cargo and astronauts to the space station, and making plans for tourism. There's even talk of building a hotel in space. Joining us is Tim Fernholz, and he covers space, the economy, and geopolitics for Quartz, wrote a book called Rocket Billionaires, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and the New Space Race. Tim Fernholz, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And to our listeners, if you want to join our conversation, and I invite you to do so, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. So, Tim, what do billionaires see in space that they find so intriguing?
A number of things. I think they see an opportunity to make some more money. Can't discount that. But these are guys, and we're talking about Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and Richard Branson, who are really inspired by space. They saw the Apollo program or the legacy of it. They were exposed to science fiction as kids and were really inspired by the vision it offered. And now, thanks to our technology economy and the other businesses that they built, they have the money to spend on it. And because of the trends in, you know, smaller microchips, smaller batteries, suddenly we have the opportunity where it's not just governments anymore, but wealthy people and businesses can also do new activity in space.
Well, let's talk about Elon Musk and SpaceX. And he gets a lot of attention. I think he knows how to do that as a businessman. but he's also, you know, a bit ahead of the curve when it comes to this space exploration. What is his passion and what is he doing?
Well, Elon Musk's passion is going to Mars. And as your previous guest just talked about, getting humans to Mars is very difficult and dangerous. And he realized that to make this sort of vision of Mars come true, what really needed to happen was to make it cheap to travel in space. And that means making a reusable rocket that you can fly again and again, like a 737 airliner. And that is what he has been doing with his company, SpaceX. He built a rocket called the Falcon 9 that today flies cargo and astronauts to the International Space Station. Its Dragon spacecraft is going to carry space tourists there in the year ahead. He's launching satellites that are going to provide internet service to people on Earth. And he's developing a new spaceship called Starship that he hopes will take people to the moon and then on to Mars. So he's been very busy, and his company SpaceX has been probably the leading firm doing big things in space.
I read a really fascinating story. A guy named Jared Isaacman, he bought, I think, 4 tickets on SpaceX, and costing millions and millions and millions of dollars. One for himself, but he's sort of opened up those other seats for people that that don't have millions and millions and millions of dollars.
Absolutely. You're talking about the Inspiration 4 mission. And that's right. Jared Isaacman is a software billionaire. He bought 4 tickets, probably cost him on the order of $240 million, around that, maybe a little less. And yeah, he's going to go up, and he is also bringing with him a cancer survivor from St. Jude's Cancer Hospital, who's a physician's assistant there now. And he's running a contest for people who donate to either St. Jude's or who sort of make a video to market his software company. And it's really interesting because it's exciting, I think, for a lot of people that, you know, it's possible to go to space if you're not an astronaut who has been, you know, training and has a PhD and was a fighter test pilot. But at the same time, it seems like the only people who get to go up have $1 billion after their name. And so there's an intentional effort here, I think, to say we need to open this up to more regular people, to anyone who is healthy enough to make this mission. And the hope overall, I think, in the space sector is, you know, while this is just super wealthy people now, they want it to be like cell phones in the late 80s and early 90s, where it was, you know, Gordon Gekko with a cell phone the size of a brick to his head. You know, 15 years later, almost everyone has a smartphone in their pocket. And maybe that's the trajectory we're on with space tourism.
Well, it's so interesting to think. I mean, astronauts go through unbelievable, rigorous training to do what they do in space, and the idea that a regular, normal, everyday human being, perhaps like you and me, could go up in space and be healthy enough, or whatever you have to be enough in order to not just survive it, but perhaps just to enjoy it and come back to Earth safe and sound.
Well, for astronauts, a lot of their training is because they need to be prepared to, you know, operate these complex space vehicles, to troubleshoot if something goes wrong, to do like a spacewalk outside and, you know, install new hardware, or to perform complex research. So a lot of that is what they're focused on in their training. The tourists are not going to have to worry about that. They just, I think, need to have decent cardiovascular health. And they can go from there. And even the European Space Agency has now put out a call for people with lower limb disabilities to try and work on getting disabled people into space. Because, you know, when humans go into space already, we're basically using a lot of technology to protect them and give them the ability to do things. And so there's no real reason we shouldn't be able to do that for anybody. The actual ride of going up into space on a rocket is about 3 G's right now, and that's comparable to a roller coaster. So it's possible to get up there.
Would you do it, Tim?
Would I do it? I'm going to wait, one, until I can afford it, which maybe will be never. But two,
or have a very wealthy friend who can buy you a ticket, right?
I know. If you're a billionaire and you want to make a friend, you can buy me a ticket. But no, seriously, it's also important to remember this expanse is still very dangerous. The Crew Dragon was developed for NASA to fly astronauts, and their requirement, one requirement, was based on this metric called loss of crew. And so there's a 1 in 240 roughly chance of loss of crew on this Dragon spacecraft. And that's one of the safest spacecraft we've ever built. So that sort of keeps in perspective how much risk there is still on this trip.
And that's Tim Fernholz, and he covers space, the economy, and geopolitics for Quartz, author of a book called Rocket Billionaires, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and the New Space Race. And any questions or comments, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Let me get to actually Kathy from Cherry Hill, New Jersey, to join us, and she is on line one. And Kathy, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question for your guest, which I find very interesting subject. I just heard before I tuned into you, China and Russia, our two arch enemies and monoliths of the whole entire world, are going to be teaming up to get to space together and to, you know, take over the space race. And my question is, what are your guest thoughts on this? And is there room for everybody? Millionaires and monoliths.
Yeah, exactly. I appreciate the call, Kathy, to Radio Times. Tim, what do you say?
Well, this is very important. And you're right. China and Russia just announced that they want to work together to explore the moon specifically. And it's kind of a big moment because the U.S. has come up with this Artemis program where we want to put people back on the moon and specifically the first woman back on the moon sometime by the end of the decade. 2024 was a mooted deadline. I think realistically that's not going to happen. And the U.S. had hoped that Russia would partner with us on this project, just like it does on the International Space Station. And now with this news, it seems unlikely. There's a lot of interest in going back to the moon now. We know there's water there. It's obviously a very prestigious thing to do geopolitically, and there's still a lot we can learn scientifically there. But there is, I think, going to be, if not conflict, then tension about how and where we operate on the moon with other countries also trying to do the same thing. The U.S. came up with this idea called the Artemis Accords last year, where it sort of proposed some rules of the road. That's still being debated, but we are seeing not quite a Cold War competition, but certainly two separate efforts emerging with the U.S. and Europe and Japan and Australia versus China and Russia, who are sort of on a parallel track.
I mean, that sounds very earthy and familiar.
Yeah.
How about, and we all know with, you know, everyone on cell phones and how we use satellites and use for communication, for weather prediction. I mean, just, and I'm assuming we're talking about private companies, perhaps the government as well, you know, sending stuff up there to help us navigate our world.
Yeah, that is a big thing that a lot of new space companies are focused on, is what we can do in space to help the Earth. So venture capitalists are putting a lot of money, especially into satellite companies that are doing a lot of different things. They're taking pictures or radar imagery of the Earth to track climate change or deforestation, to monitor the economy, where ships and trucks are going, or stockpiles of commodities like oil and copper. We're also seeing new communications technologies, satellites that provide internet service that could really help people in rural areas, for example, who don't have access to broadband right now. And there's a lot of other ideas like these. Even GPS, which is maybe the space technology we're all most familiar with, again, it's in our phones, is also a big part of the financial system. So all of this technology in space is, you know, helping the economy on Earth in different ways. And we haven't even really begun to tap into it yet. The space transformation we're seeing is really only half a decade or less old. And so a lot of the gains are still yet to come.
I mean, how crowded do you think it's going to get up there then?
Pretty crowded. And that's another big problem that people are talking about, which is the issue of space debris and space junk. And with so many new satellites, tens of thousands of new satellites potentially up in space, do we have the right traffic management rules? Do we have traffic cops? Do we have garbage trucks that can go pick up defunct satellites or broken satellites or refuel them? And this is all being talked about in the industry and in government. But one of the tricky things is that space is an international jurisdiction, and the rules and the roles of who enforces them is pretty vague. And so we're seeing lots of conversations among NGOs, among governments, about how we should approach this, but there's still not a lot of specificity, and that's something that we're going to need to develop in the years ahead if we don't want to see something like what happened at the beginning of the movie Gravity, when space debris, you know, blew up the International Space Station. That's something that people worry about, and there's steps being taken to prevent it, but that's the worst case scenario.
Yeah, we certainly don't want that. Let me get Emily from Lansdale to join our conversation. And Emily, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thanks so much for answering my question here. I just had a quick question about what your thoughts are about the long-term implications of people like billionaires and just wealthy people kind of dictating the steps we take with space exploration as opposed to scientists.
And thank you, Emily. Thanks for that call. Is it a kind of either-or thing, Tim, or scientists and these private companies, the government, NASA, are they working together? What's the relationship there?
So right now, it's not true that billionaires are dictating scientific exploration. And really, NASA is still in the driver's seat, and something called the Decadal Survey, which is a long process by which academics and researchers sort of prioritize what they want to do in space. What the billionaires are doing right now is they're making money putting space probes into space for NASA. They're a transportation service. But we're getting to the point where there are tensions. So if there are space tourists on the International Space Station, some of the resources that might have gone to science may go to these tourists, and they have to pay for it. And some people are worried about that. But what NASA thinks is that they would like to outsource operating a space habitat to the private sector so they don't have to do it anymore. The International Space Station costs about $150 billion. It's going to retire sometime in the next decade, probably. And NASA would rather not have to build it again. They'd rather someone else do that so they can focus on the next really expensive probe to Mars or deep space or really frontier science that is, you know, a novel thing compared to building a habitat in space today. But we are seeing tensions. There's something a lot of people are talking about where all of these new satellites in space that are being launched, especially some called Starlink being launched by SpaceX, have the capability of interfering with telescopes on the ground, big telescopes high in the mountains that are trying to get away from light and take long exposure pictures of the sky. Now satellites are getting in those pictures, and it's interfering with their observations. So the space companies need to figure out how to make their satellites darker, but astronomers are concerned about this as well, and it's going to be a tug of war going forward. You know, you can imagine eventually they're just going to put all those telescopes up in space, but there's going to be a transition period while we figure all of this out.
And we're almost out of time here, but I was reading about talk of building a hotel in space, and I guess, you know, that is inevitable if you've got space tourists. What do you know about that, Tim?
The company that's being talked about for building a space hotel right now is, I would say, not very credible. They don't seem to have any money or relevant experience. But yeah, a lot of people are looking forward to seeing tourism become, you know, permanent in space, to see a habitat built. There's a company called Axiom that is flying tourists to space and also wants to build a habitat that could host tourists. Oh. And if you think about, you know, like I grew up in New Hampshire. In Mount Washington is the tallest mountain on the East Coast, and there was a hotel up there, and wealthy people went up, and that was sort of the first sort of tourism up there, and that sort of led economic development. It's not quite the same analogy, but you'd want to see how we follow up with everybody and not just the billionaires.
Let me just read Rick's comment, and then we're going to have to say goodbye. Rick says, I think this massive resurgence in interest in space travel and research is because space exploration came to a virtual halt during the Obama years. We'll just put that out there. Tim Fernholz, thank you.
I want to object to that just briefly, because that's absolutely very briefly. False. That's absolutely false. And what we saw during the Obama administration was the success of NASA's public-private partnerships. That was when SpaceX really succeeded. And, you know, the Trump administration essentially carried on with what Obama and George W. Bush had been doing before him.
I appreciate that that response. Tim Fernholz, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And his book is called Rocket Billionaires, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and the New Space Race. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. And you can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.